Kazakhstan detained several officials, including a former security chief, for treason amid continued tensions in the country. The U.S. and NATO again accused Russia of preparing to attack Ukraine ahead of security talks with Moscow in a bid to de-escalate tensions. India's daily COVID cases hit a seven-month high as the Omicron variant of the virus overtakes a Delta version in the cities. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisu Mishahmadi and these are top stories this hour. Kazakhstan's National Security Committee says a former security chief, Karim Mesimov, has been arrested on suspicion of treason. That comes as tensions run high in the Central Asian nation following protests over a fuel price hike. The committee says several other officials were also arrested without specifying. Mesimova was sacked from his post this week after protesters in the main city of Almaty stormed the government buildings. Security forces are now said to have taken over the streets of Almaty and other cities after days of violence. The Kazakh government says that the unrest has left 44 people dead, including security forces and, quote, armed criminals. President Kasym Jomart Tokayev has spoken of an anti-terror operation and ordered law enforcement agencies to fire without warning. The whole country is still under a state of emergency. The unrest began over fuel price hikes but continued despite the government's resignation. A group of British lawmakers have warned of a dangerous precedent being set after protesters who toppled the statue of 17th century slave trader Edward Colston walked free from a British court cleared of criminal damage charges. But supporters of the people dubbed the Colston Four says the case was potentially motivated and should never have been brought in the first place. Amina Taylor has more.
Cleared of criminal damage charges at Bristol Crown Court, Rhiann Graham, Myla Ponsford, Jake Skous and Sage Willoughby, dubbed the Colston Four, celebrated their acquittal in a trial that's divided British public opinion. For those who had been on trial, relief and a sense of vindication.
We are ecstatic and stunned. I tried to write something ready for this moment, and I'm just so overwhelmed.
We didn't change history, we rectified history.
We illuminated history.
And this is a victory for Bristol. This is a victory for racial equality.
And this is where it began, at a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Bristol in June 2020.
I think the court accepted that this was almost a political show trial. That Boris Johnson and the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, had determined that they wanted to make an example of the Colston Four, and the courts rejected that.
The jury's verdict has garnered mixed reviews, with some MPs writing to the Attorney General, asking him to look once more at the wrong result. Elsewhere, there have been calls for the Home Secretary to explain why this case was so heavily pursued in the first place, and what happens now when that move has seemingly backfired.
The focus is now on high-profile monuments like the statue of Sir Winston Churchill, Britain's lauded World War II leader, but a figure that's being seen increasingly through the lens of his controversial views on race and empire.
New legislation being pushed through under the Police and Crime Bill will make defacing monuments punishable by up to 10 years behind bars.
Women watchers to your station will be surprised to know you can get longer for pulling down a statue under the new provisions than you do for rape, which is absolutely bizarre. But it shows the extent to which this government is intent on pursuing culture wars and criminalising the Black Lives Matter movement.
There is the hope that many local and national stakeholders will use the outcome of the Colston Four trial as a teachable moment, a chance to reflect on Britain's checkered past. But then again,
Maybe it will just be business as usual. Amina Taylor, London.
No end in sight to tensions between Washington and Moscow over Ukraine. The U.S. Secretary of State has once again warned Russia over what he called Moscow's aggression.
Russia's aggressive actions are a threat to peace and security in Europe. We're prepared to respond forcefully to further Russian aggression. But a diplomatic solution is still possible and preferable if Russia chooses it.
Blinken also accused Russia of, quote, gaslighting the world with its claim that NATO and Ukraine were threatening Moscow. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has also warned of a major movement of troops in the event of a Russian invasion of NATO countries in its vicinity. The military alliance claims Russia is building up troops in border areas to attack Ukraine. Moscow denies the allegations, saying that its movement of troops is defensive as NATO moves closer to its borders. In an effort to ease the rising tensions, U.S. and Russian negotiators are set to hold bilateral talks in Geneva on Monday, which will be followed by a NATO-Russian meeting in Brussels. Scott Bennett, a former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, says Washington's rhetoric against Russia is a sign of desperation to try and trigger a theatrical confrontation in Eastern Europe.
Russia is not a threat to the U.S. It is a blockage to the U.S. empirical ambitions. The United States, since George W. Bush and Dick Cheney in 2001, have launched an Israeli-based Odadanon plan and Project for a New American Century, in which they wanted to capture the world's territory and incorporate it into the American empire. And that has been blocked by Russia, blocked by China, blocked by Iran, indeed been blocked by many European nations. And the American desperation to try and keep that delusion alive is currently manifesting in these provocative actions against Russia in Ukraine, against China, against Iran. So it is really an embarrassing sign of the foreign policy incompetence by the State Department, by the CIA, by the senior military officials in the Pentagon. It is a sign of their desperation to try and trigger theatrical confrontations that really have no substance in reality.
India reports nearly 142,000 new COVID infections in the past 24 hours, setting another record in its daily case counts. The figure is the highest in India since the end of May. The country already saw its daily case count pass 1,000 mark on Friday for the first time in 7 months. COVID cases have been steadily rising in India in recent days due to the Omicron variant. The new strain is overtaking Delta that caused a health crisis there last spring. Restrictions have already taken effect in some cities, including an overnight curfew in the capital, New Delhi. India's total COVID infections are now above 35.37 million, one of the highest in the world. Spreading like a wildfire. Now, that is how our correspondent in New Delhi describes the ongoing COVID surge led by Omicron in India. Munawar Zaman also tells us about other reasons behind the surge.
Well, this new Omicron variant is spreading like wildfire. It wasn't anticipated that this will have such a faster pace than the earlier variants like Delta. But now what the government is right now busy doing is it is gradually bringing more measures. I could probably see the overcrowding in the buses. Markets are still bustling. People are not taking care of basic principles or the basic guidelines that the COVID requires. And the worst states are the Maharashtra, and of course New Delhi is seeing a tremendous rise in cases every single day.
Total COVID deaths in Mexico pass 300,000. That is the fifth tally in the world after the U.S., Brazil, India, and Russia. The Mexican tally includes 168 new fatalities recorded in the past 24 hours. The country also registered more than 28,000 new infections. That is the second highest daily case number there since the start of the pandemic. Mexico's total infections are above 4 million. The country has seen a surge of infections in recent weeks, particularly in its tourism hotspots following the holiday season. Despite the surge, which is driven by Omicron, Mexico has kept its borders open. The country requires no tests or vaccination passes from arriving travelers. No new restrictions have been announced either. The U.S. Labor Department says the country added almost 200,000 jobs in December. That is the United States' worst month of job creation in 2021. Economists had forecast a job growth of double that number. The slump is attributed to a surge of COVID-19 cases and the reimposition of restrictions fueled by the highly contagious Omicron variant. The new strain has sickened millions of Americans and forced airlines to cancel thousands of flights. Many are also reluctant to go back to work. In 2021, the U.S. economy bounced back from the pandemic, but payrolls remain well below their pre-pandemic levels. U.S. employment is still more than 3 million jobs lower than what it was in February 2020. Mike Harris is a finance editor of the American Journal, Veterans Today. He says there is a complex of factors for unemployment in the U.S., but the key one is the government's incompetence.
So there are multiple factions going on where you have people who are too scared to go to work, who don't want to, and people who will refuse to go to work because they don't want to support the corrupt system that is being promoted by Biden. So you have a couple of dynamics here that are really depressing the U.S. Job market. And you have the incompetence of the Biden administration. You have their collusion with foreign powers, the George Soros faction, as well as the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party. And many Americans are fleeing the cities, leaving their jobs, quitting, and relocating out into rural environments that are away from the city environments where the jobs are located in order to buy themselves some security away from the inner cities and the problems that go with it. So this is indeed a complex set of problems. And the Biden administration is doing everything they can do to make it worse. You have to realize that when you have such corruption and criminality, it doesn't sustain itself. It doesn't create value. It doesn't create wealth. And when people see that corruption, then they flee from it. So that is why a large number of people are flat out not participating in the workforce.
Moving on, three white men convicted of murdering an African-American man in the U.S. state of Georgia are sentenced for life in prison. Only one of the sentences has the possibility of parole. The white men gunned down unarmed Ahmaud Arbery in a coastal Georgia suburb in February 2020. The 25-year-old was jogging down the street when he was shot. The gunmen claimed that they suspected the black man was a burglar and tried to put him under citizen's arrest, but this count was dismissed in their defense, and they were found guilty in November. A series of racially charged attacks against African Americans, mostly by white officers, have prompted nationwide protests for racial justice over the past few years. Earlier, we were joined by our Washington correspondent, Colin Campbell, for an update on the story. He says that if it wasn't for the video evidence, the court's verdict could have been different.
William Bryan Jr., the guy they call Roddy, the one who took the video, was actually taking the video because he thought it would exculpate his two friends from what they did. So that's the really odd part. Now, if you were to really get inside of his mind and say, hey, would you have taken that video again? Chances are he probably would not have, because he thought taking the video would actually go in the opposite direction of where it led to. But of course, as we know, the video was finally released after being kept secret for seemingly months on end. And now we have the sentencing, life sentencing, for all three men. Of course, Roddy, the guy who took the video who we were just talking about, he does have the possibility of parole. But the other two, you have the McMichaels, Gregory and Timothy, the one who pulled the trigger, and then his father. They were both sentenced to life without parole. And then there will be some additional sentencing for them as well, I believe. The judge has other charges, including manslaughter and some other things that may add on to the initial murder charge. Not only that, these guys are going to be back, I believe, in federal court next month to face federal hate crime charges. So they're not done. And I think this is good for sending a message that, well, Black Lives Matter.
Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United States continues to play prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner of anyone on the planet. Despite a decade of air carnage, the only person in prison is the man who exposed it. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Jesslyn Raddick and William Nosiel Riders. This article is published under the heading, The Other Drone Casualties. The whistleblowers who tried to stop it. Stay tuned for more. The New York Times investigation into the Pentagon's civilian casualty files is some of the most important journalism in the so-called War on Terror. It methodically and thoroughly picks apart the layers of lies around drone warfare and proves that the few examples of civilian casualties that have been investigated previously were not one-off mistakes. Unfortunately, this reporting comes too late for the civilians in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria who bore the brunt of the brutal air campaigns. Over the years, a number of veterans have been sounding the alarm about precisely these issues, trying to blow the whistle while it could still save lives. We have represented more than a dozen such veterans who, despite being vindicated in their concerns, have suffered dire and ongoing consequences for their whistleblowing, on top of crippling moral injury from participating in a global assassination program. They began to come forward in 2012 and 2013, nothing. Some of them participated in the award-winning documentary National Bird in 2014. Several more risked their freedom and came forward publicly in 2015. They all bore witness to what had become essentially common knowledge among drone pilots, sensor operators, and imagery analysts. Civilian casualties were not an aberration, and much-touted policy safeguards and precision technology were little more than a facade in terms of actually protecting innocents. Operators or their supervisors would minimize concerns of children spotted in a strike with dehumanizing terms such as a fun-sized terrorist or terrorist in training, or by simply insisting the child had been a dog. People fleeing a bombed building were referred to as squirters. These whistleblowers have had to navigate abnormally high rates of PTSD, anxiety, depression, alcoholism, drug abuse, and suicide. They have been berated by anti-war groups, denied veterans benefits because they were not boots on the ground, and subject to pretextual government investigations targeting them and their families. One former service member described to New York Times magazine the lasting effects of moral injury, PTSD, an anxiety he suffered after leaving the drone program, as well as the threats and harassment he endured after speaking out. When another client was in Germany to testify before the German Bundestag about drone warfare, Air Force officials showed up on his mother's doorstep in Missoula, Montana, and told her she was being targeted by Daesh because her son was speaking out. The most severe consequences have been borne by Afghanistan war veteran Daniel Hale, who was prosecuted under the Draconian Espionage Act and is serving a nearly four-year prison sentence because he was the source for a groundbreaking reporting series and book on drone assassinations. Hale had started like other dissenters, speaking out in public forums about his experiences in the drone program after having left the military. But his conscience continued to plague him, and he had started to think of himself as a war criminal. He described his tipping point after he had unexpectedly regained access to classified drone documents at his next job as a military contractor, where his colleagues would watch drone films, raw footage of drone strikes, as a form of entertainment. The documents he later gave to journalists were concrete evidence of what he and other whistleblowers had been saying and what the Times investigation would later confirm. the claims of accuracy touted by the military and political leaders were grossly untrue, and they knew it. The military's own studies showed that up to 90% of the strike victims were not the intended target. Yet, they almost never bothered to investigate the civilian deaths they claimed to work so hard to avoid. Instead, those deaths were deemed enemies killed in action, and that inflated number of enemy casualties formed the basis for awards and promotions. When Hale attempted to explain the motivation for his actions at sentencing, prosecutors protested that he had helped ISIS and compared him to a heroin dealer who insisted that his crimes were good for the community. Hale spent the holidays isolated from friends and supporters by the contact restrictions and intense surveillance of a communications management unit where he was placed by the Bureau of Prisons under the absurd rationale that he might commit another communications-based crime from prison despite having had no access to classified material for almost a decade. He was unable to comment on recent news that yet again the military absolved itself of any wrongdoing in the horrifically botched but not atypical August drone strike in Kabul, the parting shot of the American withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of informatics.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Sudan security forces attacked anti-coup protesters with tear gas and live rounds in the African country's major cities, including the capital, Khartoum. Thousands of protesters filled the streets to express their strong opposition against the ruling military junta demanding a transition to civilian rule. Well, protests are nothing new to Sudan, where former leader Omar al-Bashir was deposed through a military coup in April 2019. After ruling over the country for three decades, in August of the same year, a transitional civilian military administration was founded to run the country. However, Sudan's military chief staged a coup and dissolved the fragile government. Abdallah Hamdok, the then prime minister, and other civilian leaders were all held in military detention. Hamdok was later released and signed a power-sharing deal with the junta. On Sunday, though, Hamdok resigned, leaving the military fully in charge. He said that Sudan was at a dangerous crossroads, threatening its very survival. Joining us on Spotlight, we have African affairs expert Lawrence Freeman, who's with us from Baltimore. And also journalist and African affairs expert Mubarak Kenya is joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Freeman in Baltimore. Sir, why, in your opinion, has Sudan's democratic revolution been put on hold?
There are many reasons for this, and it's much more complicated than the average person thinks and gets from the media. There was no real thinking in advance of what would happen with the removal of Bashir. And now that when Bashir was removed, everybody really didn't have an idea of what's supposed to happen. And therefore, the situation has been very difficult for the last 2 years. The military is not used to ruling. The military is not used to dealing with the civilian government or demonstrators. You had the role of the security forces, which have been kept out of the current situation now for a number of months. You have a number of outside countries involved, including United Emirates, Qatar, Israel, Egypt, primarily. And then you have among the demonstrators themselves, you have legitimate students and demonstrators who want a better way of life. And then, of course, you have agitators, professionals using tear gas, Molotov cocktails, etc. So it's a very complex situation. The underlying problem that the current transition is having and that the government had under Bashir is that the economy is the key, that people's standard of living has not improved. Hamdok does not actually have a lot of credibility with people in Sudan or even outside of Sudan. They need to bring in people who are going to put forward a plan for economic development that represents the real interest of the people of Sudan. Now, I don't know if Pahani has that kind of vision. It doesn't appear at the moment he does. But if we're going to change the situation, we're going to have to bring in a new policy, a new paradigm for Sudan that focuses on infrastructure, economic development, and raising the material standard of living of the people. I believe that until we do that, the situation will continue with demonstrations and killings for some time ahead.
Morag Kenya, I'd like to get your perspective on what's going on in Sudan as well. What alternatives are there now that the civilian prime minister has resigned? The military has said it wants to replace resigned Prime Minister Hamdok, but the junta has also been warned that if that happens without holding elections, it could undermine their own legitimacy and it'll also damage the democratic drive of the people of Sudan. What do you think?
Well, I think what is happening in Sudan is a continuation of what we witnessed in the North African countries like Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt. And actually, the events in Sudan are replication. They replicate what happened in Egypt, where the military hijacked the popular revolution of the people who overthrew an unpopular regime in Egypt. So the Sudanese military is reading from the same script as the Egyptian military. They have been collaborating very closely with the Fatah al-Sisi. General Burhan in Sudan has been collaborating closely, and they've been sharing notes. So we are seeing a repeat of what happened in Egypt, in Sudan. And the military, the ultimate objective of the military is not to hand over power to the civilian, but to ultimately take over the control of the country through quote-unquote democratic means, where, like we had in Egypt, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi taking power. The same thing will happen in Sudan, is most likely to happen in Sudan. So the future for now looks bleak, and the situation, I believe, is going to escalate. And of course, as Mr. Freeman said, there is the involvement of trans-regional powers who want to control Sudan for their own interests. We have Saudi Arabia, we have the UAE, and we have also the normalization deal with the Israeli regime. I think this is a major factor, that despite the fact that civilians have been killed, almost 57 civilians have been killed during the recent protests in Sudan, we are seeing very little or no condemnation from the a so-called international community. If it was happening in another country, there would have been UN resolutions, but because it's in Sudan and there is that major plan to, you know, to protect the normalization deal. So we expect the situation there to escalate.
Lawrence Freeman, the protesters, they are calling for a civilian caretaker government. They want democracy. It's democratic aspirations. As our guest Justin Tehran mentioned, the outside world, do you think, is it doing enough to support those democratic aspirations of the Sudanese people?
But I think you have to be very careful when you use the word democracy, because the United States and the West have their version of democracy, which they try to impose on other countries, including African countries. I've been in Ethiopia many times this year defending the Ethiopians, State Department, their version of democracy. There are democratic aspirations, but the aspirations that are driving the people in Sudan, I was there many, many times, is the fact that they don't have a future that can see their economic development improved, that their children can have jobs, that they can have jobs, that they can have the housing and electricity and food and running water that is required by an economy. The problem is many of the proponents from the West who call for democracy leave out completely and wrongly the question of economic development. The other problem you have in Sudan is when it was finally freed from the British colonial powers, the military was a major national institution of the country. You had the military, you had the Secret Service, and you had the civilian service sector. And right now, the civilians are not represented. They don't have a powerful voice in determining the future of the country, and they don't have any policy. And this was one of the foolish things that the West did, is they demanded the removal of Bashir over and over again, indicted him, but they had no plans for what to do afterwards for the country. And now Sudan is caught in a geopolitical manipulation, where they recognized Israel in return for some favors they were supposed to get. But the country has gotten worse after the removal of Bashir than under Bashir, and it was pretty bad under Bashir. I was there. So there's nobody in the democratic, quote, reform movement or in the military that actually has an idea of what to do to for the future of Sudan. And therefore, like my colleague on the other end of this conversation, I am too, do not see any grounds for improvement over the weeks and months ahead.
Mubarak Hania, let's go back to an issue that you just mentioned earlier, about the likes of the U.S. and the EU remaining idle if they advocate a democracy worldwide, as they claim. Why aren't they doing more in support of the protesters? Is it because Sudan has signed a pact with the U.S. on normalizing ties with Israel? Is that why Washington is most likely treading lightly here?
Yeah, exactly. Because you see, when we have a civilian government coming in power, this whole process of normalization in the Israeli regime ideally should be taken to parliament, and the parliament will approve. And the Sudanese people, as we know, over the years, they have been supporting the liberation of Palestine. Hamas had an office in Khartoum. They have been supporting Palestine. So if we were to have a truly democratic government in Sudan, devoid of external interference, this normalization deal, will be in tatters. And I think, so that's why the U.S. Is supporting this military government. And the other issue we have to mention here is that the current military rulers in Sudan, Al-Burhan and his deputy, they have been working, they have been part of the Saudi-led coalition, which is at war with Yemen, which invaded Yemen. And Sudan is a major contributor of ground forces, foot soldiers, actually, which we can say, who are in the front line in Yemen, fighting the Yemeni people. So the UAE and Saudi Arabia, their interest is in seeing that the current military regime or dispensation remains in power, because they are part of that situation in Yemen. And as we know, the Saudi war on Yemen is backed by the United States, backed by the Israeli regime. So all these factors will automatically lead to the Western, I mean, the Western countries supporting this regime in Sudan, and they will not speak out against the killing of protesters because they are supporting, they are backing, basically backing. They might speak, they might issue some resolutions for the media, but you know, behind the scenes that they are backing this regime in Khartoum, and they are backing the killing of civilians. So the people of Sudan, I think they are very resilient people, and they will continue protesting until the government, I mean the military regime, listens to their demands. And there is also, a danger of another coup within a coup actually in Sudan right now. I mean, there is talk that some junior officers, progressive junior officers in the military, might decide now, it's time to now replace the old guard who are working with the Western countries, with the Israeli right. regime, against the popular demands of the people.
Lawrence Freeman, who benefits from this disarray in Sudan? There have been allegations of foreign hands, as you also mentioned earlier, namely some Persian Gulf states and also Egypt, of going to extremes to support the junta in Sudan. Why is that?
Well, first of all, when Bashir was overthrown, and the West immediately came in and said, if you go with us on our Israeli policy, we'll make some changes in the size of your debt. Basically, Sudan has become, over the last 2 years, has lost its sovereignty. There is actually no longer an independent sovereign Sudan. And you have various forces in the world, you have geopolitical forces in the world who are using Sudan. Some are using Sudan to carry out their maneuvers with agreements with Israel and alliances with Israel. Some are using Sudan to join with Egypt to go after the Ethiopians on the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, which is unfair. And you have geopolitical forces, of financial political elites that would rather see disruption, war, and destabilization than actually stable government. And this crowd that calls for democracy, I think we have to look at them very carefully in the Biden administration. We saw in the Obama administration, you mentioned Libya earlier, the overthrow of Gaddafi, which was unwarranted, led to the destruction of the Sahel, which we are paying for now 10 years later. And therefore, this was not a productive move. What we need in the West, in my country, particularly the United States, is we need to have a new vision for Africa. We never really helped Sudan previously, and we're not helping Sudan now. Unless we have a vision that incorporates massive economic development and infrastructure, we're not really helping the people of Sudan. And in the democracy movement and the demonstrators, it's good to demonstrate. I demonstrated quite a bit in my life. But what is your policy? Who is putting forth a policy for the future of a stable, economic, prosperous Sudan? No one is at this point. And until that occurs, we have a major problem, and I don't think the demonstrations are going to stop. And I'm looking for some leadership to emerge that actually has a vision for Sudan for the future.
Mubarak Kenya, we're talking about foreign hands at play in Sudan. The Saudis come up there, the Emiratis, and also Egypt. What do each have to gain here, and why would they have any say in what's happening in Sudan?
Well, Egypt is, as we know, is a neighboring country of Sudan, same with Saudi Arabia across the Red Sea. But they are not acting as good neighbors because, as you know, as I said earlier, the Saudis have used the Sudanese army to invade neighboring Yemen. And as Mr. Freeman mentioned also, that as far as the Renaissance Dam is concerned in Sudan, the Egyptians are also using Sudan to, you know, check on Ethiopia, and they are part of that escalation happening in Ethiopia. So, and the Emiratis also, as we know, they are also involved in Yemen. So all these regional powers, they are not acting in the interests of the Sudanese people, but they are using Sudan as a tool to achieve their geopolitical objectives across the region, and not in the interests of the Sudanese people, because Sudan is a country with great potential, great agricultural potential, which can feed Africa. Sudan is also a country with great intellectual potential, but all these potentials have been undermined over the years, and now it's a country moving towards the status of a failed state, which is very unfortunate. I think that's why the people of Sudan have to, you know, sustain their protests. They have to demand that a civilian government comes in power, which is, you know, elected by the people. And unless this happens, we are going to see the military selling out the country, because as we also know that the Sudanese military controls the economy of Sudan, fully controls the economy of Sudan. Almost all the sectors are controlled, negatively controlled actually, by the military. So the military has an appetite of staying in power and exercising control, because it's in the interest of the generals to stay in power, because they are personally benefiting from being in power. But the lower ranks in the military, they do not see any interest in them, for example, going to fight in Yemen, because young people are dying, young Sudanese are dying for a war that is not theirs. They have no interest. They're going to kill, they are killing their brothers in Yemen. So there is also discontent within the lower ranks of the military in Sudan. So as long as these foreign powers are not acting in the interest of the Sudanese people, and they will not for now act in the interest of the Sudanese people, we are going to see any changes. And the other thing also we have to remember is that the reason why these Arab regimes like Egypt and Saudi Arabia and the UAE do not want to see a civilian power in place in Sudan, because that will act as an inspiration to other countries. It will act as an inspiration even to Egypt, that the Egyptians will also rise up against the military rule in their country. They will rise up against undemocratic regimes in other parts of the Arab world. So they do not want to see Sudan setting an example or being a trendsetter for other Arab countries. And that's why they're really interested in suppressing the popular uprising of the Sudanese people.
Okay, one last question for Mr. Freeman. These democratic movements, historically speaking, do they have a chance at longevity in these African and Arab countries where a so-called president or a military strongman has held on to power for so long?
Well, I think they absolutely do. The problem is you can't look at this, the situation in Sudan, isolated from the whole situation in Africa. Africa is the only continent that went through 400 years of slavery, which was a mass deportation of people. Went through 100 years of colonialism. Went through another several decades of neocolonialism. So African countries have not been allowed to develop. Many of the leaders in the 60s who were visionaries were either eliminated or assassinated. Even the situation with Gaddafi, who is not a friend of mine, I was not a fan of his, but he had some very strong policies for development. All of these leaders in the history of Africa has not been conducive to developing stable leadership. And outside forces, like the political financial elites in Paris and London and Washington and New York City, they have made sure that there is not development in Africa. There is not the development of roads and infrastructure, such as the Chinese are doing now. So this problem of having stable governments has been a problem that's been also imposed on Africa. And I agree with my colleague. None of these outside forces have the interest of Sudanese at heart. And this is something I've been fighting for many years. Even the separation of South Sudan, the people behind that in the United States did not have the interest of Sudan at heart. If you care about the Sudanese people, then they need electricity. They need clean water. They need transportation. They need good hospitals and health care. And that policy has to come with a civilian government. It can't come after it. And we have to fight for those policies in Sudan today and for a representative government.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. African Affairs expert Lawrence Freeman joining us from Baltimore, and journalist and African Affairs expert Mubarak Kenya joining us from Tehran. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us here on Spotlight. And also allow me to thank my guests for staying with us on edition of the show. It's good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Charles Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a question that a lot of people ask, and it's a very hot topic these days, and that is regarding the revolution of Amir-e-Mukhtar. Obviously, today, because of the serial of the Mukhtarnama, which is really popular, especially amongst Shia people today, a lot of people ask whether Imam Sajjad alayhi wasalam and the other Imams alayhi wasalam were actually satisfied and they were happy with the revolution that Mukhtar did, and whether his actions were satisfactory for them or not. First of all, it's necessary to keep one thing in mind, and that is that it's very difficult to come to a very certain and definitive answer to this question. First of all, because it's a question related to history, and with respect to historical events, it's very hard to come up with a very definite and certain and 100% answer with respect to exactly what happened. Secondly, especially keeping in mind the political, tense political situation in those times, it's hard for us to really come up with a definitive answer with respect to the intentions of a human being in his actions, and also whether the Imam alayhi wasalam was satisfied with a certain person or not, especially taking into consideration the tense political environment in which they live. Nevertheless, having said that, we can say that there are certain indications in some of the traditions that perhaps the Imams alayhi wasalam, they were satisfied with the revolution of Mukhtar and also his the revenge that he took from the people who perpetrated the heinous crimes against the family of the Prophet and the Imam Hussein and his family. One of those is the fact that Imam Sajjad alayhi wasalam, he prayed for Mukhtar. He prayed that God give mercy to Mukhtar. Another testament to the fact that he was satisfied with them and the Imams were satisfied with them is a tradition which says that when the head of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad was brought to Medina and presented to Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, he said that there is nobody from the Bani Hashim except that he sends his salutations upon Mukhtar and he prays for him and that he speaks good of him. And now this tradition has been related in Tabaqatul Kubra, volume 5, page 285. In another place, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam has been related to have said, praise belongs to God who took revenge for us from our enemies, and may God give reward and recompense and good to Mukhtar. This has been related in Jami' al-Riwat, volume 1, page 22. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the revolution of Amir Mukhtar and whether or not the Imams were satisfied with his actions or not. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Cleared of criminal damage charges at Bristol Crown Court, Rhiann Graham, Myla Ponsford, Jake Skous and Sage Willoughby, dubbed the Colston Four, celebrated their acquittal in a trial that's divided British public opinion. For those who had been on trial, relief and a sense of vindication.
We are ecstatic and stunned. I tried to write something ready for this moment and I'm just so overwhelmed.
We didn't change history, we rectified history.
They lied. They illuminated history.
And this is the victory for Bristol. This is the victory for racial equality.
And this is where it began, at a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Bristol in June 2020.
I think the court accepted that this was almost a political show trial, that Boris Johnson and the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, had determined that they wanted to make an example of the Colston Four, and the courts rejected that.
The jury's verdict has garnered mixed reviews, with some MPs writing to the Attorney General